This is WBFO in Buffalo. It's 43 degrees, 39 in Jamestown, 35 in Olean. The time is 9:04. 5 days after the start of that massive fire at the former Bethlehem Steel Plant in Lackawanna, the state DEC has posted initial air quality test results. State Assemblyman Mickey Curran says he's glad the agency followed through on its promise to share information, but he is concerned about its interpretation. Since day one, Kearns has been receiving calls from concerned residents, and they're still coming in, so he decided to take action.
I drafted a letter to the commissioner of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation to sort of ask for a few things to answer the questions that I've been getting since the first day. And in addition to that, I've asked that they hold a public forum to look into some of these questions that the residents have.
Kearns says residents have basic concerns like whether or not it's safe to turn their heat on. City Hall is getting a good real estate deal. For just $1, they're purchasing the old federal courthouse in Niagara Square across from City Hall. Within a few days, the sale will go through, and the city can start preparing to move the police and fire departments into that building. Mayor Brown says there will be off-street and secure parking at that site, avoiding some of the current problems at the current police headquarters.
Parking at a surface lot is more convenient, more secure than parking in a scattered fashion. So even in terms of the parking around the facility, we will see greater efficiency. We won't see double parked vehicles. We won't see impediments to the smooth flow of traffic.
Mayor Brown would not say what the schedule is for the move-in. The old police headquarters will be going on the market for redevelopment. New York State has a new toll-free hotline to report incidents of bias and discrimination. The governor announced the launch of the hotline on Tuesday after what he called a recent uptick in reports of discrimination. The hotline also allows people to file a complaint with the Division of Human Rights by calling 888-392-3644. And members of a New York City synagogue are searching an upstate landfill for a religious item that fell into a trash can last week. WHCC-TV reports a congregant at a Brooklyn synagogue lost an embroidered bag containing scrolls of parchment inscribed with verses from the Torah. The synagogue's garbage was among the downstate trash transported by train to a Rochester area landfill. In sports, the Sabres lost their fifth straight last night, 4-1 to St. Louis' Sam Reinhart, with a lone goal for the Sabres. They're home tomorrow night against the Tampa Bay Lightning. 43 degrees in Buffalo at 9:07.
Support for WBFO comes from our members and from M&T Bank. M&T opened its doors in 1856 with the aim of helping Buffalo grow and supporting those hardworking people dedicated to doing the same. The values they were founded on, responsibility, integrity, and commitment to our communities, are still alive and well as we witness the remarkable rebirth of our hometown. More at mtb.com/hometown. M&T Bank, understanding what's important for 160 years. Member FDIC.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Let's hear from a man who was one of Donald Trump's earliest and most fervent supporters. His name is Daryl Scott. He's a pastor from Cleveland who has known Trump for several years. Scott's words and views have drawn criticism from other African-American leaders during the presidential campaign, but he has been celebrating Trump's election victory, and he's excited for what this presidency will bring. Pastor Daryl Scott joined us over Skype. Give me the top one or two ideas, policies that will be most important to you for a President Trump to get enacted.
Well, that's going to be hard to do. I mean, because it depends on which lens you're looking out of. I mean, from the perspective of a black man, I want to see the inner cities revitalized and redeveloped. And, you know, he's offering tax incentives for minority businesses to locate or relocate in the inner city, not only minority businesses, but businesses in general to stimulate the economy of the inner city. So I'm excited about some of the things he's going to do, you know, as far as the African-American community is concerned.
The Democratic Party would argue that they have stood by people in the inner cities for many years. I mean, back to President Bill Clinton and before that. Was there a time that you believed in that party helping the inner cities? And was there a moment that you can look to when they really lost you and you decided that that's not the party that can help?
They pimped the inner cities. They stood next to the inner cities just like a pimp stand next to a prostitute. They pimped us out. They got monies and they fiddled while Rome burned. And the very few would profit from the disenfranchisement of the inner city. They would enact different programs and a lot of politicians padded their pockets while the community itself suffered. So no, they never did a good job with the inner city. During the most of the businesses that are owned in the city, inner city, are not owned by the residents of the inner city. There are other ethnic groups come into the inner cities and own the stores and own the businesses, and they profit from, they take from the inner city, but they don't give to the inner city. And so no, we never profited by them.
You feel Donald Trump is going to be helping to rebuild and helping communities like yours in Cleveland?
You have to understand, he looks through the eyes of a developer. He looks through the eyes of a builder. He sees these depressed conditions of the inner cities, and he looks at them as projects that he believes he can turn around. Looking at these cities, he says, hey, I can fix that. I can renovate that. I can rehab that. I can do something with that.
Pastor Scott, Donald Trump has selected a man named Stephen Bannon to be his chief strategist in the White House. He's the former chair of the publication Breitbart News. You know, it's seen as a far-right publication. It's described by many as white nationalist. Does that bother you to have someone potentially with ties to white nationalism that close to the president inside the White House?
I know Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon is a good guy. I consider him as a friend. We've had many conversations, many meaningful conversations, and I have no problem with him.
If you know him, help us understand some of these headlines that his news organization ran. I mean, suggesting that Bill Kristol, the conservative commentator, is a quote, renegade Jew. I mean, headlines about the President Obama bringing in more hating Muslims. I mean, why would he lead a news organization that would use such headlines if you say that he's a good guy you're comfortable with?
Actually, the columnist that wrote that story on Bill Kristol was Jewish. Steve Bannon didn't write the article.
But he's still chairman of the news organization at that point. I mean, doesn't he stand by what the...
Let me tell you something. I don't try to think for Steve Bannon. I can only judge the man based upon my interaction with him and the conversations I've had with him. I don't think he's a racist. He served in the United States military. He's a very educated and very intelligent man. And I don't think he was stooped to racism because I don't think he's that stupid to be a racist.
What would you tell a member of your church who supported Hillary Clinton in this campaign and is on edge right now and nervous about Donald Trump?
I don't have to tell my church that. They know Donald Trump is not a racist. Donald Trump has been in my church, and Donald Trump has been my friend for the last 5 or 6 years. So they know he's not a racist. They accept the outcome of the election. I made it clear from the very beginning that I've never tried to impress my will upon you. I don't really talk about Donald Trump in my pulpit. I never made him a part of my Sunday morning sermons or anything like that. I mean, I had a few that got disgruntled and left the church, but, you know, that's a decision that they have to live with.
Why'd they leave the church?
I guess for political reasons. I don't know. A lot of people, you know, they bought into the media portrayal of Donald Trump.
But they were believing those things and then not wanting to be in your church because they knew you were close to him.
You know, I had some people question, how can you be close to him? And I know he's not a xenophobe. I know he's not a misogynist. It's easy for me to defend him because I know him. Now, it's up to you whether you believe me or whether you believe the media.
Do you have a lot of work to do to win people over?
No, I don't. I think Donald Trump is going to prove himself. He's like defending a caged lion. I don't have to defend the lion. I just open up the cage and let him out. He can defend himself. I'll tell you this much. In the next election, if he chooses to run 4 years from now, he'll have a large number of African Americans that support him because they will have seen that he's been an effective president for our community.
All right, Pastor Scott, always good to talk to you. Thanks so much for the time. We really appreciate it.
You too. God bless you.
That was Pastor Daryl Scott in Cleveland, Ohio.
In Brazil, the first babies born with Zika-related microcephaly are turning one. It's been a long, hard road for their parents and for Brazilian researchers trying to uncover Zika's secrets. NPR's Lulu Garcia Navarro reports from Rio de Janeiro.
Fabiane Lopez is talking with her doctor at a local hospital about a prescription for her daughter, Valentina. At 11 months old and born with Zika-related microcephaly, Valentina suffers from severe seizures and she has to take a range of medication. She also has had an operation to help her digestion. Her legs are twisted, so she has mobility issues, among a range of other developmental problems. Little Valentina's short life has mostly been spent in hospitals like this one. I sit down with Fabiane after the appointment outside in the waiting room, where many more fretful babies with microcephaly and their parents are waiting to be seen. So first, some background. I first met Fabiane when Valentina had just been born. She's a single mother whose partner left her once he found out she was pregnant with a child who would probably have developmental issues. Back then, Zika was getting a lot of attention here, and those who were affected were given a lot of promises. Now,
we don't have any support. Nothing. We don't have psychological support for the parents that struggle, and we don't have support for our children who don't get the care they need.
At the beginning, Fabiane was full of a fierce kind of hope. The government had promised medical and financial help to all the children who had been born with Zika-related conditions and their families. Fabiane says, though, those promises quickly evaporated.
I go knock on one door, it closes. I go to another, it also closes. It's so hard. We feel so desperate, lost, and it hurts.
Other mothers contacted by NPR told similar stories. Fabiane says today she paid for her own bus fare to get to the hospital, and she can't afford to buy food while she waits all day to be seen.
Zika arrived like a bomb, yes, that grabbed the world's attention. But now all that has stopped.
At the same time Fabiana was at the hospital, across town in Rio, experts were gathered at a conference focused on Zika. I caught up there with Adriana Melo from Brazil's Northeast, who was one of the first doctors to make the link between the surge of microcephaly and Zika. She tells me, for us in Brazil, Zika arrived at the worst possible time, with an economic crisis and a political one. She acknowledged that the situation for parents with microcephalic children is urgent, with many not getting the help they were promised. But even scientists are struggling in Brazil these days. She says her group has been looking for funding for a study since last year, and so far, nothing. She even went to the international community, but the world seems to no longer be worried about Zika in Brazil, she says. She says it's a problem because there's still so many things that need to be discovered. How serious is sexual transmission with Zika? Will the Zika virus mutate? She says one of the big remaining mysteries is why northeastern Brazil saw such a huge spike in microcephaly that hasn't been repeated on that scale elsewhere. She says they need to study if genetics or immunity or environmental factors played a role. Roberto Medrano is the director of the medical school at Rio Federal University, and he was also at the conference. He says he doesn't see the issue of funding for families being resolved anytime soon, and he says the situation is indeed dire. He has joined the raging debate in Brazil over access to abortion for mothers whose fetuses have been severely damaged by Zika, and he says termination should be allowed. But he says even in the unlikely event that abortion is permitted, it won't help those struggling to cope now. We've never seen a microcephaly so serious and devastating as that with Zika. Those children will be dependent for the rest of their lives. Many will not have an acceptable quality of life. He says, for Brazil, this is an ongoing tragedy. Lulu Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
9:18. This is Morning Edition on member-supported 88.7 FM WBFO in Buffalo. State lawmakers who have not had a pay raise since 1999 appear no closer to getting one this year. The State Commission assembled to recommend a possible raise instead rejected that measure on Tuesday. WBFO's Michael Morozyak gathered reaction.
Had a state commission said yes, legislators who currently earn $79,500 per year would have seen a raise to nearly $117,000 per year beginning in January. The commission instead balked at the idea of raises on Tuesday, but not all lawmakers eligible for those raises are disappointed.
That's good news.
That's West Seneca-based State Assemblyman Michael Kearns, who says he's fine with what he's earning now.
When I ran for the office, once again, I was just recently reelected. I know what the salary is. I know, what the compensation is. And I think it's a fair compensation.
Legislators' pay is a controversial topic, especially in light of numerous scandals that have forced no less than 30 lawmakers from office since 2000. But downstate lawmakers have been pushing for a raise. During a visit to Buffalo on October 20th, Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie argued that the New York City area's cost of living warrants a salary adjustment.
When the salary was $79,500, That purchasing power has now been reduced to $53,000. Legislators have children that they need to help go to college. They have real lives. And people want to continue to do their jobs. And if you don't have a requisite pay, you're going to really shrink the talent pool, where you're probably only going to have the very wealthiest of New Yorkers to run for public office.
There are still some possibilities to pursue a raise, though the chances are remote. Lawmakers could call a lame duck session or appoint a new commission to reconsider in the final weeks of the year. And at least one member of the current commission has hinted they might be willing to host a special session if lawmakers agreed to ethics reforms, including a cap on outside income. Michael Mrosiak, WBFO News.
Support for WBFO comes from our members and from Bond, Schenick & King, a Buffalo law firm with offices throughout New York State, serving businesses, individuals, municipalities, and nonprofits. A commitment to service and value from a law firm responding to your unique needs. BSK.com.
This is Bird Note. More than a few birds take their names from the distinctive calls they make. And maybe the most vivid example is the call of the bobwhite. It's the only quail native to eastern North America. Officially known as the northern bobwhite, this chunky quail lives in brushy open country, grasslands, farmlands, and the edges of woods. Bobwhites are smartly feathered in rust and brown with bold face markings. Except during breeding season, bobwhites form coveys of up to 20 birds. They're one of the most economically important game birds in the U.S. But bobwhites are in trouble in most of their native range. Breaking habitat into smaller, separate pieces poses a major problem for the quail, as does the extensive use in farming of herbicides to control weeds. In addition, the birds are not adapted to the high density and close spacing of pine plantations. As a result, bobwhite numbers have plummeted. Like a number of other species of grasslands and open country, bobwhites will require more focused management of their habitat to meet the stiff conservation challenges they now face. Is there a bird or topic you would like to hear about on Bird Note? Give us a whistle. Or better yet, contact us at info@birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
You're listening to Morning Edition on member-supported WBFO.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at LumberLiquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. From Mathnasium and its Learning Center franchisees, committed to the idea that when kids understand math, they enjoy it and do more of it, leading to mastery. There are 700 Mathnasium Learning Centers, locations at Mathnasium.com. And from Ozzy, a digital magazine focused on the new and the next, like the story of the pioneering all-female government that led the frontier town of Jackson, Wyoming, in 1920. At OZY.com. Stay interesting.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. We have been listening to Democrats think through the road ahead. Neera Tanden leads the Center for American Progress, a left-leaning think tank. She's been a close advisor to Hillary Clinton and also to President Obama. And I asked her if she thinks the party has work to do reconnecting with the working-class voters who went for Donald Trump this time around.
Well, I agree that we need an economic and political reform message that addresses the needs of working class voters of all colors, not just the white working class, but working families who happen to be people of color as well. So
economic political reform message, that sounds like a bit of political speak. Like what exactly would that mean?
A better, sharper message that addresses the economic concerns of working class families. I also think that this election was in part a repudiation of the status quo in Washington. And as progressives, we need to have a message that responds to both concerns. People are obviously concerned that this economy isn't working for them And I think people were very frustrated with Washington's inability to solve problems.
So I asked Tandon whether that frustration from voters was causing her to rethink how some might see her organization. Do you worry that even an organization like yours sort of embodies this image of the liberal elite that working class voters see? I mean, people in Washington at a think tank coming up with solutions, but not really getting out there nitty gritty and helping people when they feel like they're suffering.
You know, what I would say to that is that the work we're proudest of is to raise issues like how raising the minimum wage is a challenge for all families. And it's really a challenge in this economy.
And now for another issue, Tandon had a hand in crafting the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare as it's known. And I asked her if Democrats would join with a Republican White House and Congress in an overhaul of that law, if that helps to save some of it.
President Obama has said over the last 5 years he's willing to talk to any Republican about how to fix the law. You know, the challenge has been Republicans have been hell-bent on tearing the law out from its roots. I think any Democrat would sit down with any Republican and try to address fixes to the law. At the same time, what we're looking at is throwing 20 million people off health care. And that is a big challenge that Democrats have to respond to.
But what if under a revamped Republican version, those 20 million kept their coverage, but the law was no longer considered an Obama achievement?
If there's a solution here and they want to rename it, I'm happy if they want to call it Trump Care and people keep their coverage. This is not an issue about credit. This is an issue about who, you know, people who have insurance and are deeply anxious they're going to lose it. And if we can reform the law so it works more effectively and people keep their coverage, that's fantastic. But our deep anxiety is that that is not what's unfolding on Capitol Hill.
That's Neera Tandon, president of the Center for American Progress, a left-leaning think tank.
The rules that govern who gets paid overtime are about to change. On December 1st, an additional 4 million workers become eligible to earn overtime, although it is not clear for how long. The incoming administration of Donald Trump has not said what it will do with the new regulations. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports on employees and employers in limbo.
Human Resources Director Blair Boyer finally has Dion's Pizza in Albuquerque compliant with the new overtime rules.
We've gotten in a good spot, but man, it has been a lot of work.
The complication? Under the new rules, workers have to make more than $47,476 a year in order to be considered salaried and thus ineligible for overtime. But some Dion's store managers made less than that. To avoid paying overtime, Dion's had to boost their salaries by shifting away from the bonus system it had been using.
We're going to have to rob Peter to pay Paul. So we're going to have to move money out of a pay-for-performance segment into more guaranteed type salary. And that just presents a lot of challenges in a competitive pay-per-performance organization, because what you're effectively doing is shrinking the size of the carrot.
In any presidential transition, previous policies are subject to review. Trump has pledged to undo President Obama's executive orders, dismantle the Affordable Care Act, reverse policies on clean air, immigration, and on Dodd-Frank financial reform. This week, the Congressional Budget Office said canceling the overtime rule would reduce employers' compliance costs and boost profits, a point advocates refute. This leaves businesses wondering how they should proceed on rules that might be unwound. Josh King is chief legal officer for Avvo, an online legal services company.
Well, geez, you know, we're going to go down this path and then things might really shift under us. And that's probably what the banks and financial institutions are thinking right now with respect to Dodd-Frank.
King notes most laws cannot be undone right away. In most cases, regulations would have to be repealed by Congress, or an agency must undergo the lengthy process of vetting new proposals.
It won't happen overnight, at least with some agencies, but I mean, you're going to see such a shift in approach and philosophy from the agencies. Some businesses and institutions, you know, might feel a little whipsawed by that.
So it goes with the ultimate future of the overtime rules. Making matters more complex, today a group of 21 state attorneys general will ask a federal district court to block the rules from taking effect. Rachel Gabady, an Orlando employment attorney, says she believes an injunction is unlikely, but says it raises questions.
Americans know about this. Well, what's going to happen? Am I going to get a raise, or am I going to be reclassified as a non-exempt employee so that I get overtime if I work more than 40 hours in a week.
Gebaty notes President Obama expanded sick leave and increases to the minimum wage for federal contractors by executive orders. It will be hard to undo that, even if the orders are reversed.
Oh, y'all have been earning sick leave and we're taking that away now. That doesn't go over well.
Blair Boyer at Dino's Pizza says he'll stick to the new rules regardless.
We may move forward with the plan that we have currently in place because we want the end result being ease and simplicity of use on our employees and to not have such a dramatic shakeup. Oh, we were just kidding. You know, we're going to go back to where we were. That wouldn't be good for our culture.
Who knows? Maybe the new administration won't reverse course. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
And good morning. This is member-supported 88.7 FM, WBFO in Buffalo. Cloudy today, some rain with a high of 55. Right now it is 45 degrees. Within a few days, the sign outside the seven-story building on Niagara Square will no longer say Dillon Courthouse. WBFO's Mike Desmond reports it will eventually be Buffalo's public safety building, the home of the police and fire departments.
The Brown administration is trying to shrink its list of city-owned and occupied buildings and make the remaining buildings more efficient, like a separate plan for a public works campus. While the costs and the timetables aren't being released, the new public safety building will cost several million dollars to refit it for cops and firefighters, with the sale price of $1. The current police headquarters will be sold for development. The council approved the purchase yesterday, rejecting a suggestion to buy the old Kmart on Broadway. Council President Darius Pridgen says that didn't work, although the community wanted it.
They did still want it, and I can understand why. I mean, to be very honest, if that building, if it wouldn't have been cost prohibitive, if we wouldn't have had to add on space to it, to me, it would have been the perfect building. I mean, you know, to bring police and fire right there in the neighborhoods. However, from what we're told, it would have cost over $30 million.
Pridgen says something had to be done about the current antiquated headquarters because it's old and tired and not large enough for current needs. Fire headquarters and its maintenance facilities will stay with the city. In the new complex, cops and firefighters will work together, especially if in the same field, like arson. The new building will have a lot of off-street parking, replacing the tangled on-street parking of the current police headquarters. Mike Desmond, WBFO News.